Good morning. Kind of move some stuff here. There we go. So, many of our fundamentalist brothers and sisters believe that the Bible's book of Genesis contains all the science that we'll ever need to know. The books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, plus a dash or two of the New Testament, provide the law. Good enough for everyone, anytime, any place. So is the book of Numbers where we should get our mathematics? Actually, Numbers is another book that's filled with laws, along with some ripping good adventure stories. The original Hebrew name for this book is Bemidbar, in the desert, which might not make you think of math at all. It might make you think of want. And what is it that the people want? They want food. Well, actually, they've got food. Moses has led them to a place where they get all they can eat of that famous food known as manna from heaven, because it seems to appear out of nowhere while they're sleeping. Here's the book. The people went round gathering it and ground it in a mill or crushed it with a pestle, and it was then cooked in a pot and made into pancakes. Did you know there were pancakes in the Bible? It tasted like cake made with oil. When the dew fell on the camp at nighttime, the manna fell with it. It's really an insect secretion that forms on tamarisk trees, and it's used even today as food by desert nomads. But no Bible stories had taught the people that. There were no Bibles yet, right? They'd been living as slaves, building the cities and monuments of Egypt, so they didn't know very much about open places like the desert. But they did know good cuisine. They knew good food, glorious food. And they soon got bored with their divine pancakes. So the Israelites began to weep again. "Who will give us meat to eat?" they said. "Think of the fish we used to eat in Egypt, the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we are withering away. There is nothing wherever we look except this manna from heaven." You would think that having plenty of food to survive on would be enough for anyone who has just escaped from generations of slavery. The waters of the sea have parted. They've crossed to safety while all their pursuers have been drowned. God has liberated them. They are free at last to go their own way. But now what do they want? Meat and fish in the middle of the desert. Plus cucumbers, leeks, onions, and garlic. Here in the desert of Numbers, where they should be counting their blessings, they seem ready to give it all up for what? Bad breath and belching? What are God and Moses to do with such people? What should we do now? How about some music? But no burping, please, from those who had cucumbers with their breakfast.
If you will all rise, we will be singing together. The lyrics will be projected over here, and I will be directing Deborah, who will be accompanying us on piano.
Is it worth the waiting for if we live till 84? All we ever get is gruel.
Well,
every day we say our prayers. Will they change the bill of fare? Still we get the same old gruel. There's not a crust, not a crumb. Can we find, can we beg, can we borrow, can we catch? But there's nothing to stop us from getting a thrill when we all
we
Religion is such a serious business, after all. Thanks so much for preparing that. Well, complaints. Everyone's got them, and it's not just the people. God and Moses have had a good number of their own complaints to this cranky book of Numbers. Moses heard the people weeping, each family at the door of its tent. God's anger was greatly aroused. Moses, too, found it disgraceful, and he said to God, "Why do you treat your servants so badly? In what respect have I failed to win your favor for you to lay the burden of all these people on me? Was it I who conceived all these people? Was I their father for you to say to me, 'Carry them in your arms like a foster father carrying an unweaned child to the country which I swore to give their fathers'? Where am I to find meat to give all these people, pestering me with their tears and saying, 'Give us meat to eat'? Food, glorious. I cannot carry all these people on my own. The weight is too much for me. If this is how you mean to treat me, please kill me outright. If only I could win your favor and be spared the sight of my misery." Kvetching goes way back. It's hard to say if Moses is just looking for a sympathetic ear or if he really expects God to provide. Complaining like an angry father seems to make things worse. God tells him to assemble the people at the tent of meeting, which must have been something like the principal's office. "Bring them there and say to the people, 'Purify yourselves, for tomorrow you will have meat to eat, since you have wept in God's hearing, saying, "Who will give us meat to eat? How happy we were in Egypt." Very well. God will give you meat to eat. You will eat it not for one day or two or five or 10 or 20, but for a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and sickens you, since you have rejected God who is among you and have wept before him saying, "Why do we ever leave Egypt?" Bad enough when it's just dad. It's even worse when mom gets mad. You can imagine God shaking a rolling pin or a big wooden spoon. "First I give you freedom, then I feed you all with manna from heaven, and now you want meat plus garlic, leeks, and onions? What, so you can find each other in the dark by sniffing? I'll give you meat, so much that you'll be sorry for ever asking. Here's how she does it." I mean, he, sorry. We all know God's a boy, right? "A wind sent by Yahweh started blowing from the sea, bringing quails, which it deposited on the camp. They lay for a distance of a day's march either side of the camp, 2 cubits thick on the ground. Zillions of birds, like in the children's story. The people were up all that day and night and all the next day collecting quails. The least gathered by anyone was 10 homer. Then they spread them out around the camp. The meat was still between their teeth, not even chewed, when God's anger was aroused by the people. God struck them with a very great plague." So now the people lie in heaps as well. That's what you get for asking. That's what you get for asking. They asked for meat and they asked for fish, but what they got was quails. I guess that birds come somewhere between the other two in the great order of things. They lay 2 cubits, or about 3 feet thick, 10 homers minimum per person in volume, or 3,600 liters. Numbers enough to sicken everyone in the whole book of Numbers. They stopped chewing, but even if they went on eating as fast as they could, imagine what would happen once all those fowl went foul. Spread for miles around. What more could God do to rub their noses in it? It was once common, as many of us older folks remember, to punish kids for smoking. Remember how? By making them sit down and finish off a whole pack. It's a time-honored method. Give them what they think they want more than they can stand. Rub their noses in it. Now, the worst Christmas that I ever had was the one when I got exactly what I asked for. Let me explain. I was 8 years old and my parents had separated. My sister and I were living with my mom in Florida while Dad stayed back in Illinois. He came down one late December to visit, and the adults tried unsuccessfully to work out some sort of reconciliation. The tension was deeper than cubits of quails, and things started going bad quickly. My sister and I were just little kids, and of course, we were worried about how Christmas was going to go, especially in the presents department. To call us selfish would hardly be justice, but that's what our parents saw. They decided to take us shopping separately. Mom took my sister someplace for girl things, while Dad took me to where they had toys and sporting goods. The idea was pretty much buy them everything they ask for so they can't complain. They couldn't hear each other. They had run out of things to say, and now they didn't want to hear any more from their children. Not from their children either. All I can remember my dad saying as we shopped was, "Now, what else do you want?" I guess I really was a selfish kid because I can't remember anything that my sister got while out shopping with our mom. But honestly, I only remember one of my own so-called presents. For months, I'd been watching commercials for the Great Garloo, the green creature that you might have seen in our little mailing about this service. Green plastic monster, about 2 feet tall. He was inspired by the monsters of cheap sci-fi movies. Garloo the Mighty! Garloo the Untamed! Garloo the Terrible! The ads showed him towering over a cityscape made of toy trains and buildings, knocking things down and causing panic in the streets. Next, the camera pans back and we see a boy and his sister playing together, just like Peter T. Hooper and Liz, just like me and my sister Christine. The announcer says in a tone of great concern, "Who can stop him? Who can stop the Great Garloo? Who can control this monstrous creature?" Then he shifts to a happy voice. "You can, kids! With these battery-operated controls, you can make Garloo go, stop, bend, pick up, turn." The boy uses them to make Garloo grasp his sister's doll with green foam rubber padded hands and bring it to where she's having a nice tea party with her other dolls. She nuzzles him gratefully like he was a clever puppy. "Yes, Great Garloo, almost 2 feet tall, will be your faithful servant." Garloo brings the boy a teacup from his sister's table, and the whole scene of catastrophic destruction has become one of cheerful domestic sharing. Garloo's just part of a big happy family. Now, why would a kid in my situation have wanted a toy like that? But there was no joy for me in the Great Garloo. Not when I picked him out and my father brought him to the counter. Not when I went through the charade of opening him on Christmas morning after he'd been gift-wrapped. Our parents' tactics were every bit as powerful as those of God and Moses had been for the fussing Hebrews. Rub their noses in it. That should stop their endless demands and petitioning for this, that, and the other. It's a tactic that can be very effective for discouraging individuals or communities from speaking up about what they think they need. At least it seems like it should be effective. Sometimes I wish that I could use it myself. Sometimes I get frustrated with people in this country. Like when I hear that bacon-wrapped, deep-fried corn dogs are selling out at state fairs in a country that's now 60% overweight or obese. Don't stop with the corn dogs. Push the idea of a fourth meal. Layer on extra slabs of cheese and meat and wash it all down with soft drinks by the gallon and soda mugs so big you could farm fish in them or maybe raise flocks of quails. Heck, let's just deep fry everything, including the melons and the cucumbers, before they even reach the store. Save people the trouble. I get at least as cranky as Moses when people seem to vote against their own best interests, or worse, when they fail to vote at all. Sometimes I want to say, fine, go ahead. Vote a straight ticket of anti-government vandals and let's see how they govern. Let's see how you like private roads and bridges with armed toll collectors every 10 miles or so. Enjoy your red state life with those staggeringly higher rates of teen pregnancy, divorce, suicide, violent crime, and yes, dependence on government programs. Funny how where families are the least intact, you hear family values preached the loudest. If you blame secular law and government for not keeping things together, replace it with religious law. I'm ranting. Replace it with religious law, so long as it's the right religion. Why stop there and not go further? Go ahead. Get your science from the Bible and teach that to your kids. Outlaw abortion and contraception. Restrict the sale of any medicines that have been developed through applied evolutionary theory. Give the crazies power. And then see if you can make the monster you've unleashed bend and serve you like the great Garlou. Let them carry us all to a nice little tea party where we'll enjoy perfect domestic tranquility now and forevermore, except for the religious wars you've called for both at home and overseas. Do it all for God and country, and may God rub your noses in it. Maybe I better stop and take a deep breath through my own nose. And let it out slowly. You can do the same if you want to. I didn't mean to wind you up so much. Maybe God and Moses should have done the same before they threw a tantrum while leading folks to their new country. After all, what did the people really mean when they asked for meat, fish, melons, cucumbers, onions, leeks, and garlic, quote, like we used to eat in Egypt? Are they really rejecting freedom or being disloyal to their faith and traditions? Let's think about those words, like we used to eat in Egypt. Those words really speak a mouthful of many different flavors. Manna from heaven might keep you alive, but it's not enough. It's not enough to help you thrive. And that's what the people want. To thrive, not just survive. A diet of nothing but pancakes won't do it for them anymore. They've been altered by their time among those other people, the Egyptians. Their tastes have changed and grown. They're a new people, bigger and more complex in experience and desire. They're not just Hebrews anymore. They've Egyptianized a bit, though they might not even know it. God and Moses see the danger. If they've got a taste for Egypt now, what will they want in the future? Scrambled egg super? We're headed for a land of milk and honey, but the next thing you know, they'll want to add cardamom or mint or other foreign flavors. Better nip this in the bud before we start to like the flavor too. Instead of spitting or cursing, what if God and Moses had offered their blessings? That's not the usual way things go with the human phenomenon that we call religion. I know. The book of Numbers, like so many religious texts, seems to advocate the idea of loyalty to one's group to the exclusion of all others, of their gods, their customs, the food they eat or the way that they eat it. But also, like so many religious texts, it pushes this to such extremes that it almost invites us to imagine alternatives. Heaps of dead birds and heaps of dead people, just because they want more variety? Is this how we really want to live? Do we want to live in a religious, ethnic, and political monoculture? On a spiritual diet that's flat as pancakes? Even if they're holy pancakes, do you think there'll be enough? Unity and solidarity can be wonderful, and I'm sure that that's what the Bible is trying to cultivate, but it often seems to also cultivate exclusivity, a fear and a hatred of the dangerous other that can easily fuel wars or an institutionalized cruelty that deforms our lives even in peacetime. Can we have one without the other? Unity without exclusivity? Can we do it? I hope, that's a large part of what our own religious movement tries to do. Where's the order of service? Got your order of service handy? If you look at the back of your order of service, you'll see a statement of our principles, the principles and sources of our living tradition. When I started serving here as your minister almost 3 years ago, I asked for these to be included here, and our worship team agreed. Like an ungrateful kid, I think I forgot to ever say thanks. Thanks, worship team. You've made it much easier for me to segue to the conclusion of so many sermons by saying, if you look on the back of your order of service, you'll see. Can you count how many times I've done that in 3 years? If you look on the back of your order of service, you'll see something important that will help you understand what I'm trying to say. Of course, I'm also saying it to prod you. When I do that, I'm saying it to prod you to reread and reclaim for another week what we might call our one-page Bible. A quick reminder of what's special about this particular religious tradition. But I've forgotten to point out what's one of the most important parts, the very last words on the page. So here it comes, just in time for Christmas. It's something that you'll find in every religious tradition. It's a blessing, though it's a strange one. Grateful for the religious pluralism which enriches and ennobles our faith, we are inspired to deepen our understanding and expand our vision. As free congregations, we enter into this covenant, promising to one another our mutual trust and support. Does that seem a little bit long and awkward? Well, yeah, the batter for this pancake is still pretty lumpy. No surprise. It hasn't been stirred for very long. It's 50-some-odd years. This is a young religious movement. I get so frustrated when I hear people say, I don't think the UU movement's going anywhere. Where were the Christians after 50-some years? Where were the Buddhists? Give it time, people. Give it time. No, the batter hasn't been stirred for very long. The celebration of pluralism and diversity is still something fairly new in what we call religion. At the religious stage of the book of Numbers, God and Moses still aren't ready to count other people in. Stick to your pancakes. Stick to your own kind. They aren't ready to see that blessing diversity supports the unity of the whole human family. But many of us do feel ready. Many of us do feel ready and feel more ready every day. I don't mean to rub anybody's nose in it, but if this last midterm election shows us anything, I think it shows us that. A celebration of diversity. I know that right here, right now, we are eager to get on with the celebration. Eager to get on with the celebration. So let me wish happy holidays to all of you. From me, from Peter T. Hooper, and his wonderful variety of birds, and of course, happy holidays from the great Garlou.
I invite you all now into a spirit of meditation. Get comfortable, close your eyes if you wish. You may feel the floor beneath your feet supporting you. You may feel the gravity weighing on your body. You may be aware of the light and your strength uplifting you.